This is tape 3, side 2, continuing the memorial of Mirza Muhammad Ivakhil from page 109. He lived with pomp and splendor like a great prince. He was one of the most remarkable men of his time, for within his palace he carried on a life of gratification and opulence, but he left his pomp, style, and retinue behind, occupied himself with his business affairs, and realized great profits. The door of his house was always open. Turks and Persians, neighbors, strangers from far places, all were his honored guests. Most of Persia's great, when they came on pilgrimage to the holy shrines, would stop at his house, where they would find a banquet laid out, and every luxury ready to hand. The Haji was indeed more distinguished than Persia's grand vizier. He outshone all the viziers for magnificence, and as the days passed by, he dispensed ever more largesse to all who came and went. He was the pride of the Persians throughout Iraq, the glory of his fellow nationals. Even on the Turkish viziers and ministers and the grandees of Baghdad, he bestowed gifts and favors, and for intelligence and perceptivity, he had no equal. Because of the Haji's advancing years, toward the end of his days, his business affairs declined. Still, he made no change in his way of life. Exactly as before, he continued to live with elegance. The prominent would borrow heavily from him and never pay him back. One of them, the mother of Aga Khan Mahalati, borrowed 100,000 tumans from him and did not repay one penny, for she died soon after. Footnote: the Baghdad period in Baha'i history was from April 8, 1853 to May 3, 1863. According to various estimates, the tuman of the day ranged from $1.08 to $1.60. End of footnote. The Ilkhan, Ali Khuli Khan, was another debtor. Another was Saifud Dali, a son of Fath Ali Shah. Another, Valiye, a daughter of Fath Ali Shah. These are only a few examples out of many from among the Turkish Amirs and the great of Persia and Iraq. All these debts remained unpaid and irrecoverable. Nevertheless, that eminent and princely man continued to live exactly as before. Toward the close of his life, he conceived a remarkable love for Baha'u'llah and most humbly would enter his presence. I remember him saying one day to the Blessed Beauty that in the year 1250 and something over, Mirza Mahab, the famed astrologer, visited the shrines. Quote, "One day he said to me," the Haji continued, "Mirza, I see a strange, a unique conjunction in the stars. It has never occurred before. It proves that a momentous event is about to take place, and I am certain that this event can be nothing less than the advent of the promised Qa'im," unquote. Such was the situation of that illustrious prince when he passed away, leaving as heirs a son and two daughters. Thinking him to be as wealthy as ever, the people believed that his heirs would inherit millions, for everyone knew his way of life. The Persian diplomatic representative, the latter-day Mojtahids, and the faithless judge all sharpened their teeth. They started a quarrel among the heirs so that in the resulting turmoil they themselves would make substantial gains. With this in view, they did whatever they could to ruin the heirs, the idea being to strip the inheritors bare, while the Persian diplomat, the Mojtahids, and the judge would accumulate the spoils. Mirza Mosa was a staunch believer. His sisters, however, were from a different mother, and they knew nothing of the cause. One day the two sisters, accompanied by the son-in-law of the late Mirza Syed Riza, came to the house of Baha'u'llah. The two sisters entered the family apartments, while the son-in-law settled down in the public reception rooms. The two girls then said to Baha'u'llah, quote, "The Persian envoy, the judge, and the faithless Mojtahids have destroyed us. Toward the close of his life, the late Haji trusted no one but yourself. We ourselves have been remiss, and we should have sought your protection before. In any case, we come now to implore your pardon and help. Our hope is that you will not send us away despairing, and that through your favor and support we shall be saved. Deign then to look into this affair and to overlook our past mistakes," unquote. Replying, the Blessed Beauty declared with finality that intervention in affairs of this kind was abhorrent to him. They kept on pleading with him, however. They remained a whole week in the family apartments, clamoring every morning and evening for favor and grace. Quote, "We will not lift our heads from off this threshold," they said. "We will seek sanctuary here in this house. We will remain here by the door of him who guards the angels until he shall deign to look into our concerns and to save us from our oppressors," unquote. Each day, Baha'u'llah would counsel them, saying, quote, "Matters of this kind are in the hands of the Mujtahids and the government authorities. We do not interfere in such affairs," unquote. But they kept on with their importunities, insisting, imploring, begging for help. It happened that the house of Baha'u'llah was bare of worldly goods, and these ladies, accustomed to the best of everything, could hardly be satisfied with bread and water. Food had to be procured for them on credit. Briefly, from every direction, there were problems. Finally, one day, Baha'u'llah summoned me to his presence. Quote, "These esteemed ladies," he said, "with all their exactions, have put us to considerable inconvenience. There is no help for it. You will have to see to this case. But you must solve this entire complicated matter in a single day," unquote. The next morning, accompanied by Akai Kalim, I went to the house of the late Haji. We called in appraisers, and they collected all the jewels in an upper apartment. The ledgers and account books having to do with the properties were placed in a second room, the costly furnishings and art objects of the house in a third. A number of jewelers then went to work and set a value on the gems. Other experts appraised the house, the shops, the gardens, the baths. As soon as they began their work, I came out and posted someone in each room so that the appraisers could duly complete their tasks. By this time, it was nearly noon. We then had luncheon, after which the appraisers were directed to divide everything into two equal parts so that lots could be cast. One part would be that of the daughters, and one that of the son, Mirza Musa. I then went to bed, for I was ill. In the afternoon I rose, had tea, and repaired to the family apartments of the mansion. Here I observed that the goods had been divided into three parts. I said to them, quote, "My instructions were that everything should be divided into two parts. How is it that there are three?" unquote. The heirs and other relatives answered as one, quote, "A third must certainly be set aside. That is why we have divided everything into three. One share is for Mirza Musa, one for the two daughters, and the third we place at your disposal. This third is the portion of the deceased, and you are to expend it in any way you see fit," unquote. Greatly disturbed, we told them, quote, "Such a thing is out of the question. You must not require, for it cannot be complied with. We gave our word to Baha'u'llah that not so much as a copper coin would be accepted," unquote. But they, too, swore upon oath that it must be as they wished, that they would agree to nothing else. This servant answered, quote, "Let us leave this matter for the present. Is there any further disagreement among you?" "Yes," said Mirza Musa. "What has become of the money that was left?" Asked the amount, he answered, 300,000 tumans. The daughters said, "There are two possibilities. Either this money is here in the house, in some coffer, or buried hereabouts, or else it is in other hands. We will give over the house and all its contents to Mirza Musa. We, too, will leave the house with nothing but our veils. If anything turns up, we, as of now, freely accord it to him. If the money is elsewhere, it has no doubt been deposited in someone's care, and that person, well aware of the breach of trust, will hardly come forward, deal honorably by us, and return it. Rather, he will make off with it all. Mirza Musa must establish a satisfactory proof of what he says. His claim alone is not evidence," unquote. Mirza Musa replied, quote, "All the property was in their hands. I knew nothing of what was going on. I had no hint of it. They did whatever they pleased," unquote. In short, Mirza Musa had no clear proof of his claim. He could only ask, is such a thing possible that the late Haji had no ready funds? Since the claim was unsupported, I felt that pursuing it further would lead to a scandal and produce nothing of value. Accordingly, I bade them, quote, "Cast the lots," unquote. As for the third share, I had them put it in a separate apartment, close it off, and affix a seal to the door. The key I brought to Baha'u'llah. The task is done, I said. It was accomplished only through your confirmations. Otherwise, it could not have been completed in a year. However, a difficulty has arisen. I described in detail the claim of Mirza Musa and the absence of any proof. Then I said, Mirza Musa is heavily in debt. Even should he expend all he has, still he could not pay off his creditors. It is best, therefore, if you yourself will accept the heir's request, since they persist in their offer, and bestow that share on Mirza Musa. Then he could at least free himself from his debts and still have something left over. On the following day, the heirs appeared and implored the Blessed Beauty to have me accept the third share. This is out of the question, he told them. Then they begged and entreated him to accept that share himself and expend it for charitable purposes of his own choice. He answered, there is only one purpose for which I might expend that sum. They said, that is no concern of ours, even if you have it thrown into the sea. We will not loose our hold from the hem of your garment, and we will not cease our importunities until you accede to our request. Then he told them, I have now accepted this third share, and I have given it to Mirza Musa, your brother, but on the condition that from this day forward he will speak no more of any claim against yourselves. The heirs were profuse in their thanks, and so this weighty and difficult case was settled in a single day. It left no residue of complaints, no uproar, no further quarrels. Mirza Musa did his best to urge some of the jewels on me, but I refused. Finally, he requested that I accept a single ring. It was a precious ring set with a costly pomegranate ruby, a flawless sphere and unique. All around the central stone it was gemmed with diamonds. This, too, I refused, although I had no ab to my back and nothing to wear but a cotton tunic that bespoke the antiquity of the world. Nor did I own a copper coin. As Hafiz would say, quote, an empty purse, but in our sleeve a hoard, unquote. Grateful for the bounty he had received, Mirza Musa offered Baha'u'llah everything he possessed, orchards, lands, estates, but it was refused. Then he appointed the ulamas of Iraq to intercede for him. They hastened to Baha'u'llah in a body and begged him to accept the proffered gift. He categorically refused. They respectfully told him, quote, unless you accept, in a very short time Mirza Musa will scatter it to all the winds. For his own good, he should not have access to this wealth, unquote. Then, in his own hand, Mirza Musa penned deeds of gift, made out according to each of the five creeds, in Arabic and Persian. Two copies he made, and chose the ulamas as his witnesses. Through certain ulamas of Baghdad, among them the famed scholar Abdus Salim Effendi, and the erudite and widely known Sayyid Davood Effendi, he presented the deed of gift to Baha'u'llah. The Blessed Beauty told them, quote, we are appointing Mirza Musa himself as our deputy, unquote. After Baha'u'llah's departure from Rumelia, Mirza Musa, with a promissory note, purchased from the government the tithes of Hindiye, a district near Karbala, and suffered a terrible loss, close to 100,000 tumans. The government confiscated his properties and sold them for next to nothing. When told of the matter, Baha'u'llah said, quote, do not speak of this ever again. Do not so much as utter a word about those estates, unquote. Meanwhile, the exile from Adrianople to Akka took place. Mirza Muhammad went to the government authorities and said to them, I am the deputy, Vahil, of Baha'u'llah. These properties do not belong to Mirza Musa. How is it that you have taken them over? But he had no documents to support him, for the title deeds were in Akha, and on this account the government rejected his claim. However, in the process, he became known to all as Mirza Muhammad the deputy. This is how he received the title. When we were in Adrianople, Mirza Musa sent on the ruby ring through Sayyid Ali Akbar, and the Blessed Beauty directed us to accept it. After we reached Akka, the believers felt ill and lay suffering in their beds. I sent the ring to India to one of the friends, asking him to sell it with all possible speed and forward the proceeds to us in Accra to be expended on the sick. That blessed individual never sent us a penny. 2 years later, he wrote to say that he had sold the ring for £25 and had spent that sum on the pilgrims. This, when the ring was of such great value. I made no complaint. Rather, I praised God, thanking him that out of all that wealth, not a fleck of dust had settled on my robe. Mirza Mohammed was taken prisoner and sent away from Baghdad to Mosul, where he fell a prey to fearful ills. He had been rich. In God's path, he was now poor. He had enjoyed his ease and comfort. Now, for the love of God, he suffered pain and toil. He lived on for a time in Mosul, suppliant, resigned, and lowly, and then, severed from all save God, irresistibly drawn by the gentle gales of the Lord, he rose out of this dark world to the land of light. Unto him be salutations and praise. May God shed down upon him the waters of forgiveness and open before his grave the gates of heaven. Haji Mohammed Rizay Ishirazi. Haji Mohammed Rizay came from Shiraz. He was a man spiritually minded, lowly, contrite, the embodiment of serenity and faith. When the call of God was lifted up, that needy soul hurried into the shelter of heavenly grace. As soon as he heard the summons, quote, "Am I not your Lord?" unquote, he cried out, quote, "Yea, verily," unquote, and became as a lamp to the people's feet. For a long time he served the Afnan, Haji Mirza Muhammad Ali, and was his loyal and close companion, trusted in all things. Later, following a journey to distant countries, he went to the Holy Land, and there, in utter submission and lowliness, bowed his head before the sacred threshold, and was honored with entering the presence of Baha'u'llah, where he drank in endless bounties from cupped hands. For quite a time he remained there, attending upon Baha'u'llah almost every day, encompassed by holy favor and grace. He was outstanding as to character, and lived after the commandments of God, tranquil and long-suffering. In his surrender to God's will, he was selflessness itself. He had no personal aims whatever, no feeling of attachment to this fleeting world. His one desire was to please his Lord, his one hope to walk the holy path. He went on then to Beirut, serving the honored Afnan in that city. He spent a long time in this wise, returning again and again to enter the presence of Baha'u'llah and gaze upon that most great beauty. Later, in Sidon, he fell ill. Unable to make the journey to Accra, in perfect acquiescence and contentment, he ascended to the Abha kingdom and was plunged in the ocean of lights. By the supreme pen, endless bounty was bestowed upon his memory. He was indeed one of the loyal, the steadfast, a solid pillar of servitude to Baha'u'llah. Many and many a time, from the lips of the Blessed Beauty, we heard his praise. Unto him be greetings and praise, and the glory of the All-Glorious. Upon him be compassion and most great mercy from the Lord of the High Heavens. His shining grave is in Sidon, near the place called the Station of John the Holy. Hossein Effendi Tabrizi. This youth was from Tabriz, and he was filled with the love of God like a cup flowing and brimming over with red wine. In the flower of his youth, he left Persia and traveled to Greece, making his living as a merchant there, till a day came when, guided by divine bounty, he went from Greece to Smyrna, and there he was given the glad tidings of a new manifestation on earth. He shouted aloud, was frenzied, was drunk with the music of the new message. He escaped from his debits and credits, set out to meet the Lord of his heart, and entered the presence of Baha'u'llah. For some time, a trusted attendant and companion, he served the Blessed Beauty. He was then directed to seek a lodging in the city of Haifa. Here he faithfully waited upon the believers, and his home was a way station for Baha'i travelers. He had an excellent disposition, a wonderful character, and high spiritual aims. He was friendly with friend and stranger alike. He was kind to people of every nation and wished them well. When the Most Great Light ascended to the concourse above, Hossein Effendi remained faithful to him, steadfast and firm, and, as before, he continued to be a close friend to the friends. Thus he lived for a considerable period, and felt himself better off than the kings of the earth. He became the son-in-law of Mirza Mohammed Kuli, brother of the Blessed Beauty, and remained for a time peaceful and serene. He carefully avoided any occasion of being seduced into error, for he dreaded that the tempest of afflictions might mount in fury, surge ever higher, and sweep many a soul into the fathomless gulf. Footnote: for the tribulations following Baha'u'llah's departure, see God Passes By, chapter 15, unquote. He would sigh and mourn, for his fear was with him at all times. At last he could bear the world no longer, and with his own hands stripped off the garment of life. Praise be unto him and salutations, and the mercy of God and divine acceptance. May God pardon him and make him to enter the highest heaven, the paradise that towers above all the rest. His sweet-scented grave is in Haifa. Jamshid Ikurji. Yet another of the immigrants and settlers was the valiant Jamshid Ikurji, who came from Georgia, but grew up in the city of Kashan. He was a fine youth, faithful, trustworthy, with a high sense of honor. When he heard of a new faith dawning, and awoke to the tidings that on Persia's horizons the Sun of Truth had risen, he was filled with holy ecstasy, and he longed and loved. The new fire burned away those veils of uncertainty and doubt that had closed him round. The light of truth shed down its rays, the lamp of guidance burned before him. He remained in Persia for a time, then left for Rumelia, which was Ottoman territory, and in the land of mystery, Adrianople, won the honor of entering the presence of Baha'u'llah. It was there that his meeting took place. His joy and fervor were boundless. Later, at Baha'u'llah's command, he made a journey to Constantinople with Acha Muhammad Bakhir and Acha Abdul Ghaffar. In that city, the tyrannists imprisoned him and put him in chains. The Persian ambassador informed against Jamshid and Ostad Muhammad Ali e Dalak as enemy leaders and fighters. Jamshid he described as a latter-day Rostam, that is, Persia's Hercules, while Muhammad Ali, according to the envoy, was a ravening lion. These two respected men were first imprisoned and caged, then they were sent out of Turkish territory under guard to the Persian frontier. They were to be delivered over to the Persian government and crucified, and the guards were threatened with terrible punishments should they once relax their vigilance and let the prisoners escape. For this reason, at every stopping place, the victims were kept in some almost inaccessible spot. Once they were thrown into a pit, a kind of well, and suffered agonies all through the night. The next morning Jamshid cried out, "O you who oppress us, are we Joseph the prophet that you have thrown us in this well? Remember how he rose out of the well as high as the full moon? We too walk the pathway of God. We too are down here for his sake, and we know that these depths are the heights of the Lord." Once arrived at the Persian frontier, Jamshid and Muhammad Ali were handed over to Kurdish chiefs to be sent on to Tehran. The Kurdish chiefs could see that the prisoners were innocent men, kindly and well-disposed, who had fallen a prey to their enemies. Instead of dispatching them to the capital, they set them free. Joyfully, the two hastened away on foot, went back to Baha'u'llah, and found a home close by him in the most great prison. Jamshid spent some time in utter bliss, receiving the grace and favor of Baha'u'llah, and ever and again being admitted to his presence. He was tranquil and at peace. The believers were well pleased with him, and he was well pleased with God. It was in this condition that he hearkened to the celestial bidding, quote, "O thou soul which art at rest, return unto thy Lord, well pleased with him, and well pleasing unto him," from the Quran 89:27. And to God's cry, "Return," he replied, "Yea, verily." He rose out of the most great prison to the highest heaven. He soared away to a pure and gleaming kingdom out of this world of dust. May God succor him in the celestial company, bring him into the paradise of splendors, and safe in the divine gardens, make him to live forevermore. Salutations be unto him and praise. His grave, sweet as musk, is in Acha. Haji Jafar e Tabrizi and his brothers. There were three brothers, all from Tabriz: Haji Hassan, Haji Jafar, and Haji Tahi. These three were like eagles soaring. They were three stars of the faith, pulsing with the light of the love of God. Haji Hassan was of the earlier day. He had believed from the new luminary's first dawning. He was full of ardor, keen of mind. After his conversion, he traveled everywhere, through the cities and villages of Persia, and his breath moved the hearts of longing souls. Then he left for Iraq, and on the beloved's first journey, attained his presence there. Once he beheld that beauteous light, he was carried away to the kingdom of splendors. He was incandescent. He became a thrall of yearning love. At this time, he was directed to go back to Persia. He was a peddler, a vendor of small wares, and would travel from city to city. On Baha'u'llah's second journey to Iraq, Haji Hassan longed to behold him again, and there in Baghdad was once more bedazzled by his presence. Every so often he would journey to Persia and then return, his thoughts centered on teaching and furthering the cause. His business fell apart, his merchandise was carried away by thieves, and thus, as he put it, his load was lifted from him. He was disencumbered. He shunned every worldly tie. He was held fast as by a magnet. He fell hopelessly, madly in love with the tender companion, with him who is the well-beloved of both worlds. He was known everywhere for the ecstasy he was in, and experienced strange states of being. Sometimes, with utmost eloquence, he would teach the faith, adducing as proofs many a sacred verse and holy tradition, and bringing sound and reasonable arguments to bear. Then his hearers would comment on the power of his mind, on his wisdom and his self-possession. But there were other times when love suddenly flamed within him, and then he could not remain still for an instant. At those times he would skip and dance, or again, in a loud voice, he would cry out a verse from the poets or a song. Toward the end of his days, he became a close friend of Jinabi Munib. The two exchanged many a recondite confidence, and each carried many a melody in his breast. On the friend's final journey, he went to Azerbaijan, and there, throwing caution to the winds, he roared out the greatest name, Ya Baha'u'llah Bha. The unbelievers were joined forces with his relatives, and they lured that innocent, that man in his ecstasy, away to a garden. Here they first put questions to him and listened to his answers. He spoke out. He expounded the secret verities of the faith and set forth conclusive proofs that the advent had indeed come to pass. He recited verses from the Quran and traditions handed down from the Prophet Muhammad and the holy Imams. Following that, in a frenzy of love and longing rapture, he began to sing. It was a Shahnaz melody he sang. The words were from the poets, to say that the Lord had come, and they killed him, they shed his blood, they wrenched and hacked his limbs apart, and hid his body underneath the dust. As for Haji Muhammad Jafar, the gently born, he too, like his brother, was bewitched by the blessed beauty. It was in Iraq that he entered the presence of the light of the world, and he too caught fire with divine love, and was carried away by the gentle gales of God. Like his brother, he was a vendor of small wares, always on a journey from one place to the next. When Baha'u'llah left Baghdad for the capital of Islam, Haji Jafar was in Persia, and when the Blessed Beauty and his retinue came to a halt in Adrianople, Jafar and Haji Tahi, his brother, arrived there from Azerbaijan. They found a corner somewhere and settled down. Our oppressors then stretched out arrogant hands to send Baha'u'llah forth to the most great prison, and they forbade the believers to accompany the true beloved, for it was their purpose to bring the Blessed Beauty to this prison with but a few of his people. When Haji Jafar saw that they had excluded him from the bands of exiles, he seized a razor and slashed his throat. The crowds expressed their grief and horror, and the authorities then permitted all the believers to leave in company with Baha'u'llah. This because of the blessing that came from Jafar's act of love. They stitched up his wound, but no one thought he would recover. They told him, "For the time being, you will have to stay where you are. If your throat heals, you will be sent on, along with your brother. Be sure of this." Baha'u'llah also directed that this be done. Accordingly, we left Jafar in the hospital and went on to the Akha prison. 2 months later, he and his brother, Haji Tahi, arrived at the fortress and joined the other prisoners. The safely delivered Haji grew more loving, more ardent with every passing day. From dusk till dawn he would stay awake, chanting prayers, shedding his tears. Then one night he fell from the roof of the caravanserai and descended to the kingdom of miracles and signs. Haji Tahi, born under a fortunate star, was in every sense a true brother to Haji Jafar. He lived in the same spiritual condition, but he was calmer. After Haji Jafar's death, he would stay in one room, all alone. He was silence itself. He would sit there, all alone, properly and courteously, even during the night. One midnight, he climbed up to the roof to chant prayers. The next morning, they found him where he had fallen, on the ground, by the wall. He was unconscious, and they could not tell whether this was an accident or whether he had thrown himself down. When he came to himself, he said, quote, "I was weary of this life, and I tried to die. Not for a moment do I wish to linger in this world. Pray that I may go on," unquote. This, then, is the life story of those three brothers. All three were souls at rest. All three were well pleased with their Lord and well pleasing unto him. They were flames, they were captives of the faith, they were pure and holy, and therefore, cut off from the world, turning their faces to the Most High Kingdom, they ascended. May God wrap them in the garment of his grace, in the realm of forgiveness, and immerse them in the waters of his mercy for ever and ever. Greetings be unto them, and praise. Haji Mirza Muhammad Tahi, the Afnan. Among those souls that are righteous, that are luminous entities and divine reflections, was Jinab-e-Muhammad Tahi, the Afnan. The Afnan are the Bab's kindred. His title was Vakilud Dali. This eminent Baal was an offshoot of the holy tree. In him an excellent character was allied to a noble lineage. His kinship was a true kinship. He was among those souls who, after one reading of the Book of Ikhan, became believers, bewitched by the sweet savors of God, rejoicing at the recital of his verses. His agitation was such that he cried out, "Lord, Lord, here am I." Joyously he left Persia and hurried away to Iraq. Because he was filled with longing love, he sped over the mountains and across the desert wastes, not pausing to rest until he came to Baghdad. He entered the presence of Baha'u'llah and achieved acceptance in his sight. What holy ecstasy he had, what fervor, what detachment from the world. It was beyond description. His blessed face was so calmly, so luminous, that the friends in Iraq gave him a name. They called him the Afnan of all delights. He was truly a blessed soul, a man worthy to be revered. He never failed in his duty from the beginning of life till his last breath. As his days began, he became enamored of the sweet savors of God, and as they closed, he rendered a supreme service to the cause of God. His life was righteous, his speech agreeable, his deeds worthy. Never did he fail in servitude, in devotion, and he would set about a major undertaking with alacrity and joy. His life, his behavior, what he did, what he left undone, his dealings with others, were all a way of teaching the faith, and served as an example, an admonishment to the rest. After he had achieved the honor, in Baghdad, of meeting Baha'u'llah, he returned to Persia, where he proceeded to teach the faith with an eloquent tongue. And this is how to teach, with an eloquent tongue, a ready pen, a goodly character, pleasing words, and righteous ways and deeds. Even enemies bore witness to his high-mindedness and his spiritual qualities, and they would say, quote, "There is none to compare with this man for his words and acts, his righteousness, trustworthiness, and strong faith. In all things he is unique. What a pity that he is a Baha'i," unquote. That is, quote, "What a pity that he is not as we are, perverse, uncaring, committing sins, engrossed in sensuality, the creatures of our passions," unquote. Gracious God, they saw with their own eyes that the moment he learned of the faith, he was transformed. He was severed from the world, he began to emit rays from the Sun of Truth, and still they failed to profit by the example he set. During his days in Yazd, he was outwardly engaged in commercial pursuits, but actually teaching the faith. He His only aim was to exalt the word of God, his only wish to spread the divine sweet savors, his only thought to come nearer and ever nearer to the mansions of the Lord. There was no remembrance on his lips but the verses of God. He was an embodiment of the good pleasure of Baha'u'llah, a dawning point of the grace of the greatest name. Many and many a time Baha'u'llah expressed to those about him his extreme satisfaction with the Afnan, and consequently everyone was certain that he would in future initiate some highly important task. After the ascension of Baha'u'llah, the Afnan, loyal and staunch in the covenant, rendered even more services than he had before. This, in spite of many obstacles, and an overwhelming load of work, and an infinite variety of matters, all claiming his attention. He gave up his comfort, his business, his properties, estates, lands, hastened away to Ishkabad, and set about building the Mashriq-Khalajkar. This was a service of very great magnitude, for he thus became the first individual to erect a Baha'i house of worship, the first builder of a house to unify man. With the believers in Ishkabad assisting him, he succeeded in carrying off the palm. For a long period in Ishkabad he had no rest. Day and night he urged the believers on. Then they too exerted their efforts and made sacrifices above and beyond their power, and God's edifice arose, and word of it spread throughout east and west. The Afnan expended everything he possessed to rear this building, except for a trifling sum. This is the way to make a sacrifice. This is what it means to be faithful. Afterward he journeyed to the Holy Land, and there, beside that place where the chosen angels circle, in the shelter of the shrine of the Bab, he passed his days, holy and pure, supplicating and entreating the Lord. God's praise was always on his lips, and he chanted prayers with both his tongue and heart. He was wonderfully spiritual, strangely ashine. He is one of those souls who, before ever the drumbeat of, quote, "Am I not your Lord?" unquote, was sounded, drummed back, quote, "Yea, verily thou art," unquote. It was in the Iraq period, during the years between the 70s and the 80s of the Hijra, that he first caught fire and loved the light of the world, beheld the glory dawning in Baha'u'llah, and witnessed the fulfillment of the words, quote, "I am he that liveth in the Abha realm of glory," unquote. The Afnan was an uncommonly happy man. Whenever I was saddened, I would meet with him, and on the instant joy would return again. Praise be to God, at the last, close by the shrine of the Bab, he hastened away in light to the Abha realm, but the loss of him deeply grieved Abdu'l-Bahá. His bright grave is in Haifa, beside the Hazrat al-Quds, near Elijah's cave. A tomb must be erected there and built solidly and well. May God shed upon his resting place rays from the paradise of splendors, and lave that holy dust with the rains that beat down from the retreats of the exalted companion. Upon him be the glory of the All-Glorious. Abdullah Baghdadi. When he was very young, people thought of Abdullah Baghdadi as a libertine, solely devoted to pleasure. He was regarded by all as the sport of inordinate desires, mired down in his physical passions. But the moment he became a believer, he was carried away by the sweet savors of God, and was changed into a new creation. He found himself in a strange rapture, completely transformed. He had been of the world, now he was of heaven. He had lived by the flesh, now he lived by the Spirit. He had walked in darkness, now he walked in light. He had been a slave to his senses, and now he was a thrall of God. He had been clay and earthenware before, now he was a dear-bought pearl, a dull and lusterless stone before, now a ruby glowing. This is page 130. This memorial will continue on the following tape.